Welcome to the After Show podcast. I'm Jason. That is Jacob. This is the show after the show, and we've got an interesting one for you today because we're going to play a unedited 20-minute interview with the director of a movie I really, really liked. It's by Bart Layton. He's the director, American Animals. So we'll play that after the commercial break. Did I seem tired today?
What did you?
So much energy drinks in my system right now.
Really?
I went to bed and I was so proud of myself. I went to bed at 6:30, took a sleeping pill and everything because I wanted to get in here early to edit the Bart Layton interview that we ended up airing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get here at like 3:50, 4 o'clock, and I got in at like 4. And I woke up at 11. So I got from 6:30 to 11, give or take a few minutes. I laid in bed until 2.
Nice.
And then I finally fell asleep for an hour, right? For an hour and 15 minutes, because I got up a little after 3.
Yeah.
And I was more tired when I got up than when I was just laying there trying to go back to sleep. Because once you take one of those naps, like, you know, the nap that goes a little bit too long, you fall into the REM sleep, whatever.
I'll probably take one of those today.
Like, but you go that far?
Yeah.
I can't do that. It's the worst. And I get groggy and angry and just not, I didn't want to get up.
Yeah. But I just won't be really functional. Like, I won't enjoy any of the hours between basically 2 p.m. and 6
p.m. Well, that's your depression.
No, I can't function, and I won't,
you
like, deprocess anything.
You don't enjoy your time now.
Huh?
You're not enjoying your time now.
If I take a nap, I will, like, I'll at least be able to process
maybe
things.
Maybe your naps are too long.
No, I'm describing to you, wait, what do you...
I'm saying maybe your naps are too long, and that's what's...
That's the only time I feel that I, like, can experience those hours with any sort of, like, lucidity.
I'm just saying try a 30-minute nap or a 20-minute. Because those are the ones that supposedly, if you do them twice a day...
sometimes they help a little bit,
yeah,
but...
it's better than the long naps.
No.
It is. According to science, science isn't lying.
You can't take naps at all.
I can't at all, but you can.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying that I have more experience about it than you do.
I'm saying science tells you you're full of it. Okay, American Animals is...
science.
Oh, shut up. Everyone does. American Animals is a movie. It's coming out next Friday. We're going to take a quick break, and then you'll get to hear the interview with Bart Layton.
You ever feel like you're waiting for something to happen?
It pains me to see you embarrass your father.
But you don't know what it is.
You're in, or you're out.
That thing that could... make your life special.
You're in, or you're out. You're in, or you're out.
How can I tell you if I'm in or I'm out without you telling me the first thing about what I might be in or out of?
This would be something dangerous and very exciting.
Boom, boom.
This library is home to the most valuable book in the United States.
$12 million. You really need to see how easy this is gonna be.
Oh, you know this from all your previous heists?
Boom, boom.
Can I just say how dumb this entire thing is?
How do you know no one's gonna get hurt?
I don't want you waking up years from now wondering what could have happened and who you could have been.
Are you sure you're okay?
This is my life. This isn't some game.
Thanks for coming on. What's the one question you tend to get from virtually everyone as you talk about the film?
It's probably, how did you find the story? What drew you to it? And why did you make the film?
Mm-hmm. How did you find the story?
Because you're going to ask it.
I have to, only because...
I thought you were going to say...
The other stuff I'm not going to ask. But this one I do want to ask, because I didn't know there was a Transylvanian University. I did not know, any of this information.
It sounds sort of Dracula-like, doesn't it?
It kind of does, and it feels like the imposter in that... I'm surprised I had not heard that story before because it's so crazy.
Yeah. Well, I read about it in a magazine on a flight, I think, and I may be misremembering it. I think I was coming back from Sundance having screened The Imposter there. And, just read about this, as you say, this quite crazy story. And, you know, everyone loves a heist movie. I thought it was fascinating for many reasons, not least because, you know, the people who committed the crime were not your average criminals. I mean, yeah. They were well-to-do, you know, young men, relatively privileged from, you know, well-educated from supposedly, you know, good families. So I was immediately intrigued to try and understand more of what would have led them to do something like this, especially a crime as kind of audacious and seemingly, you know, hard to imagine that they could ever really have thought that they would get away with it. So I started writing to them, the real guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a spoiler, but at this point they were, you know, serving quite a long prison sentence. And it was the letters that they wrote back to me and my producing partner that I think took it from a good story and a, you know, a great yarn to a really good story, like kind of an amazing story.
Yeah.
And also one that felt sort of timely, because a lot of the things that they wrote about in their letters were not about, it wasn't really about money, it wasn't, mm-hmm. it was more about this sort of existential crisis and, you know, and feeling like they needed, you know, one of them wrote about, you know, desperately yearning to become an artist and you know, and I know him very well now and he is a very brilliant artist. Mm-hmm. Technically, he's fantastic. But I think, you know, he read about all of the great artists and the one thing they all had in common was they'd had difficult lives and they'd suffered and they'd known terrible anguish, and he felt that his life was too nice and too, you know, middle class and suburban.
Hadn't earned.
Exactly. What was he ever going to have to make art about, or what story was he ever going to? And, you know, and as a dramatist, that idea of, you know, someone whose main problem is they don't have a problem, but they need to kind of find one or manufacture one, is such a extraordinary idea. And also it seemed to speak to that thing of that generation of rather lost young men, you know, searching for an identity, searching for something that was going to make them interesting and special, and, you know, and that was a big part of what was motivating. You know, I'm not sure they ever thought they were really going to go through with it, but this thing that sort of started as a fantasy, you know, can you plan the perfect robbery, spiraled, kind of snowballed into something else.
Do you sympathize with them?
Yeah, I do up to a point. I mean, I don't think I did until I got to know them, until, you know, and they started writing these very honest letters. I mean, I think some people, you know, will find them very, very relatable, very human, and other people will probably think, you know, they didn't really have anything to complain about, so why should we feel sympathy for them? But I think because of the honesty of what they say and what, you know, and the fact that clearly, you know, and I don't want to give too much away, but clearly they deeply regretted what they did almost instantly. I think people will be surprised by how much they can relate to them.
Well, and the way it's being described is like they're hapless, which I don't think at least at the start, I didn't think that they were hapless. And when they were going through how this would actually work, it did kind of make sense in there's not really any armed guard there. It is just one older librarian who's guarding incredibly expensive books.
I mean, I think they're probably hapless in the sense that, like, if you're not a criminal and you've never committed a criminal act before, you know, how do you plan one?
Yeah.
And the way they did that was by watching all the old heist movies, you know. And, you know, the great irony about that is most of those movies don't end well. You know, the people end up in real trouble.
They don't get away.
They don't often get away. And so, but I think it was more that they were just drawn into the adventure. You know, one of them described it to me in one of his letters from prisoners, like it was like their version of Fight Club. You know, it was like a secret that they had, and it set them apart from everyone else. You know, it made them different from other people. It made them sort of, it gave them something that was an escape from the mundanity of their normal lives. And, you know, and they lived in this pretty small sort of suburban world of Lexington, Kentucky, which, if you've been there, is, you know, it's nice, but it's not the most exciting place.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think they wanted to push the boundaries and ended up, you know, it just ended up going way, way too far.
So obviously it's a bit of a hybrid. There's obviously more of a traditional narrative storytelling filmmaking than it is documentary. But what made you decide not to go the imposter route and just do a straight documentary?
Just because it felt like it should be a bigger movie. You mm-hmm. know, documentaries are hard, I think, in the cinema. I mean, more so now than, you know, a few years ago. I think people think about, you know, I think Netflix has become a place to watch documentaries and feature documentaries, and I think the cinema has become a harder place for that. And I also think, you know, I wanted to do a movie that was a proper heist movie. You know, it delivers, it's, you know, and it's got phenomenal actors in it, and it's a bit, but I also didn't want to completely, you know, the thing that always made it so extraordinary was the fact that it's a true story. You know, I wanted to find a way of a form to the film that would make the audiences sit up and really lean in a different way, because you know, the thing is, you go to the movies and you suspend disbelief, you know, you leave that at the door and you just go off into movie world, and the consequences of the characters' actions don't necessarily affect you. Whereas in this, because you're constantly reminded that it's true, you are completely hooked in. You know, a couple of people have come up to me after screenings and complained that it was too suspenseful. You know, that it was too like nerve jangling, which is great as far as I'm concerned.
You want that.
But yeah, but I think a lot of that is because of the way the real people are also in the film, that you remember that and all the rest of it, and you go on this quite white knuckle kind of roller coaster ride with them.
How much of what you end up putting in the movie was not necessarily based on their recollections? Because obviously if you've got four people and you address this in the movie, that sometimes there's some disagreement on what ended up happening, but they could still all be putting a slightly rosier look on what happened than the facts of the matter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is that thing of, like, you know, them being slightly unreliable narrators, but also, you know, memory is pretty unreliable. You know, we tend to think that, you know, your memory is this really great document of what happened, but actually it's really often it's not, you know, and you know, they remembered things happening, you know, that they remember the same events happening quite differently. And you see in the movie, we sort of play with that idea of conflicting memories, conflicting realities and all that.
Did you find yourself believing one person more than the other? It does end on a note of, well, was Warren necessarily being honest about some of what he did during the planning?
Yeah, there was a few twists in the film, which we don't want to spoil for people who are going to see it, but I think I found them all honest in a way, but I also felt like there were certain things, you know, with Warren, who is the sort of charismatic lunatic at the heart of it, you know, he really wanted them to go through with it. I don't know if he wanted them to go through it, but he really wanted to know what was on the other side of that line that should never be crossed. And I think there were lots of obstacles that would have stopped them going through with it. And he would find a way to kind of get beyond that obstacle, to get around it. And, you know, there's a question as to how much of that was true, how much of that was stuff that he invented, or how much of it was stuff that he kind of made up in order to keep the fantasy guy, or in order to keep the plan alive, mm-hmm. so that they would actually go through with it.
But they all did end up going through with it, and they had moments of, why did we just do this? I'm thinking particularly, I forget his name, from Glee, who's
Blake,
absurdly handsome, and it just pisses me off. But, you know, he kind of had this moment of like, no, we should not be doing this. And so did all four of them, did you believe that all four of them were looking for identity, or was there...
No, I think that's the interesting thing. I think they all had really different motivations. I think, you know, Blake Jenner's character... And he is annoyingly handsome, you're right. No, so his character, Chaz, excuse me, definitely, you know, I think he wanted the money, right? You know, in his mind, it was like, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. And we better have it completely nailed down. Every piece of it has to be. Whereas I think for the others, there was this, it was, you know, more of a kind of existential question. You know, with Spencer, you know, the artist, he was looking for an experience. You know, he was looking for something that was going to totally turn his life upside down. But I don't think, but I think he was constantly conflicted by, you know, wanting to do this thing that was going to change the course of everything that followed. And maybe for the better, but maybe for the worse. And also what was going to happen if they went through with this for his parents, the community, you know, if it went wrong and they got caught, what would happen, you know, it's a pretty close community. And, you know, the price that his family would have to pay and, you know, and as you see in the film, you know, a lot of those fears are realized.
Which means he kind of got what he wanted, right? Well, in this weird self-defeating way.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I want audiences to kind of go away thinking about, really. You know, did they get what they wanted, or did they destroy everything?
What did you learn during this?
Well, I suppose I learned... I thought a lot about the increasing pressure on young people to kind of live a so-called extraordinary life. You know, that now we live in a culture where there's a sort of measurement of how interesting you are. You know, we're constantly putting stuff out into social media, you know, Twitter, Instagram,
Snapchat. Documenting everything.
Yeah, everything. There's a way of broadcasting your life to the world. And then what you do is you put that out there and you wait for people to respond and like it and kind of validate you. And that, you know, that when we were growing up, there was never a measurement for how, you know, of course you wanted to be popular, but there wasn't a measurement for how kind of valuable you were in the world, you know, how famous you are. And now, you know, in a way, for these young men, you know, their parents were successful. That's what the American dream looks like, right? Nice house, nice car, you know, 2.4 kids, Labrador, all of that kind of stuff. But for these young men, that's like mediocrity, and there's nothing worse than mediocrity, right? You know, and that change in the culture was something I really found myself thinking a lot about, like what, you know, why, you know, if the most important thing for you as a young person is that you are getting recognition, or that you are special, or that you're kind of getting some sort of endorsement of your value in the world, you know, and the way you get that endorsement is by having however many thousand Instagram followers or whatever it is, you know, but then there's an increasing pressure to be more and more kind of different or extraordinary, and most of us are not. But I think one of the motivations behind this crime was to do with that pressure to be remarkable in some way.
It's interesting because when we talk about how remarkable it is, it could also mean you're notorious, right? It can mean you do something
totally
bad, and then we see what happened at Santa Fe High School last week. Was that another kid who is now growing up in this area where you have to be known for something, and if you can't be known for something positive, maybe do something negative?
I mean, you know, the beginning of the movie starts with a quite an ominous kind of, you know, if you go into it not knowing it's a heist movie, you know, you could be forgiven for thinking it's about something much more awful or, you know, darker. But I have to say, you know, and people may disagree, but I think a lot of what was motivating this behavior was not a million miles away from some of the things that motivate much more horrific behavior. And, you know, in the UK, where I live, you know, we've got big issues with young men joining, you know, jihad, ISIS, and all the rest of it. And the truth is, a lot of that is about a kind of desire to, you know, do something kind of, you know, completely unthinkable to, you know, to, you know, to the kind of most punk rock thing, the most anti-establishment, anti-social thing. And a lot
so it's not socioeconomic, which is usually...
I mean, you know, that is always a huge factor in it, but there are people from all, you know, who aren't just from the lowest socioeconomic backgrounds who are joining and doing things. And, you know, so... And a lot of it is this kind of... is motivated by this need that you were talking about to leave a mark on the world, whether it's good or bad.
This is one of the films where I don't think people should look into beyond, you kind of have to say it's a heist movie, I guess.
Yeah.
But beyond that, right, I mean, this movie is somewhat diminished if you do all the research of what actually happened beforehand.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, the thing that's been interesting, you know, we screened this film at Sundance, we've had audiences young and old, and the reaction has been unbelievable. Yeah. I think probably better than I could ever have expected, you know, that actually... You know, it feels like it's a movie about young people. I think if you watch the trailer, it sort of feels like it's aimed towards young people. But some of the people who've been the most, like, incredible supporters have been parents.
Yeah.
And older women and, you know, even granny. You know, it's literally like, I think people... of all ages find something in there that they can relate to.
Is there any part of you that feels like you might be glorifying the act by giving them credit?
Well, I think if you watch the movie, there is no question whatsoever that that there's a sense where that they are glorifying it up to the point where they actually do it. And when they actually do this thing and cross the line, I think it's very hard to argue that there's any glorification of that.
Yeah, there are consequences that they're dealing
with. Well, not just the consequences, but the way in which it is portrayed and the way in which the crime is portrayed is anything but glamorous.
Yeah.
I mean, it is definitely the opposite. And we were very, you know, I was very conscious, you know, and when I was writing the script, you know, there's a moment where it goes from... you know, Ocean's 11 to Dog Day Afternoon. You know, it's not a fantasy anymore. It's not fun. It's suddenly it's real. And that is kind of brutal and shocking.
Yeah. Last question. I don't have my notes in front of me, but I believe I saw MoviePass. Was that the front? Okay. Because I live in constant fear that MoviePass is not sustainable. What is their involvement in the film and the general distribution of the film and getting actual butts in seats, because that's part of their business model long term, is we know what types of movies you like, we're now going to hyper target you so we can get you in front of a film.
Well, their involvement is simply that they came on board with another distributor at Sundance. They were thinking about getting behind, you know, a movie, I don't think as distributors, but kind of, you know, they were looking for something that they could get behind, which and have some ownership of. And this was the one for them. This was the one that they thought would speak to their audience the best. And so they've just been working alongside the other distributors called The Orchard, who are very, very good and, you know, have done some great films. And they're sort of, you know, they're kind of co-distributors of it. But I think they just really, they felt that it was something that was going to speak to their audience and wanted to be kind of behind it. I think they're, at the moment, they're sort of, you know, and I don't know really anything about the business model, but I think their main objective and focus is really keeping their subscribers as happy as they possibly can be.
One thing that'll keep them happy is actually go see this movie. So
yeah,
I appreciate you giving me some time today.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks.